She's come to be known as the trap therapist. We talk with this Milwaukee-based clinical social worker on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Tarsha Wiggins uses elements of hip-hop, of electronic dance music, R&B, all to make mental health care more accessible, less about sitting on a therapist's couch for a customary talk therapy session. And she holds another trap therapy event tonight for kids, pairing urban music with mental health messages. Join in on new approaches to mental health wellness, 800-642-1234. Tarsha Wiggins has more than a decade of experience in behavioral health, a certified alcohol and drug counselor as well, founded Speak Wellness Behavioral Health Consulting. Tarsha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Why does trap music make people open up more comfortable during sessions?
I think it's just the power of music. You know, when you bet that favorite tune comes on, it releases those endorphins, that serotonin in the brain, and it's just that feel good comes over you. And when that happens, I just gently come in and build after I built some rapport, and we now can have some really uncomfortable conversations that are life changing.
How do you build rapport with people who come to these events?
Oh, that's a great question. So I am building rapport via social media before most people even get through the door. We have been friends social media wise for weeks or months or perhaps years at this time. But ultimately on those platforms, I am planting seeds, building rapport in terms of the engagement level, the messaging, the vulnerability, the sharing, and a lot of things that I share on some of the social media platforms such as Facebook and Instagram and TikTok are mental health tips and tricks, things that you can do to help you really understand what is a boundary and how do I maintain boundaries? What is a coping skill and why are they important? What's meditation or mindfulness? So I've done that work prior to most people entering the door. And then for those individuals that do attend some of my sessions that we have not had the opportunity to meet and greet via social media platforms, when you walk through the door at Trap Therapy, you feel like you're home and that's intentional. Someone is there to greet you at the door, a big smile, music is playing, food is available, drinks are available, and it is a warm and welcoming environment. Mm. And oftentimes, trap therapy sessions and our focus at Speak Wellness is to focus on the Black and Brown community. So when you enter a space where most people look like you, talk like you, dress like you, you feel like you're at home.
Mm. You gave our producer, Max, some music as examples, as you talk about hearing music at the door. Let's hear a song you use in trap therapy sessions. This is Power by Kanye West.
I'm living in that 21st century, doing something mean to it. Do it better than anybody you ever seen do it. Screams from the haters, got a nice ring to it. I guess every superhero need his theme music. No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours.
Okay, so what's happening when you play a song like this in the session? What are your attendees doing?
So this is a great example of how we just pair interactive, energetic, fun, uplifting, and high energy music. So we've used this song to transition out of one of our breakthrough sessions. And this was particularly about how we cope with things and the power of our thoughts and our mind. And we talk about when you get to a place where you can start doing the work around your negative thinking, recognizing when you're having irrational thoughts or belief systems, what that does to your behavior, because in the cognitive behavioral therapy therapeutic model, it says what you think is what you believe and what you believe is what you act out and find. So if you go around thinking that no one loves you, that you're unworthy, that you can't do something, you think those things so long that you start to believe. And when you believe those things, you go make that happen in the world around you, at work, relationships, families, friends, whatever those circumstances are. But after you engage with me at Trap Therapy and we talk about what needs to happen for you to shift that thinking, how do you challenge those thoughts that no one man, no one thought, no one thing can have power over you anymore?
That mindset, and it's such a shift, but it can permeate so many aspects of your life is what I hear you say. I just want to reintroduce you, Tarsha Wiggins, for a moment, Milwaukee licensed clinical social worker. And as we talk about a form of therapy that she has coined trap therapy, using urban trap music to drive conversations about mental health, you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tarsha, you know, people who come sometimes opening up in front of a group, even if the strangers come from your background or look like you, that can be still really tough to open up. Are your attendees asked to speak or share about what they're going through in these sessions?
Absolutely. So there are opportunities where we have like a talk back session or a processing opportunities for individuals to process, and they can share if they like to. What I have found in these communal spaces is that individuals, by the time we've done our work of for about 45, maybe 50 minutes of work together, and most individuals are ready and open and willing to share on some level and or ask questions that can be pretty vulnerable to ask in front of other people. So my feedback that I've gotten from participants has oftentimes been the best part is the talk back. Is to be able to ask those follow-up questions like, well, when I'm struggling or if I'm having these thoughts and if I, you know, ask myself these two thought challenging questions and I'm still stuck, what do I do next? How do I take this thought and I put it on the shelf and still able to function or push through my day? So oftentimes though, that tends to be the best part of the session is when people are willing and feel comfortable enough to be vulnerable. And I take that sincerely to heart that I've created a space at times for 100 plus African Americans or Blacks in the city of Milwaukee that we can come together and have very vulnerable conversations around mental health.
Mm. You've been a social worker for years now. I'm wondering, have you ever been surprised by things at these sessions? I mean, you've seen a lot. Have you been surprised?
At this point, I have not, but I think that's because of my bearings and how I got started. I started off as a child protective social worker. So I think after about a year into that role, nothing surprised me. After doing that diligent work, and shout out to all the ongoing child protective social workers in the city of Milwaukee and out in the world. That is a very difficult job. We appreciate the hard work you're doing. But after doing that work, and that's really what sparked me to want to know more about substance use and dependency, just seeing so often that families did not want to intentionally harm or neglect their children. They were sick. They were ill. They had untreated mental health issues and or dependency concerns. And it was culturally accepted to self-medicate versus seek mental health treatment. And just from there, I shifted my career, focused more on the clinical side, acquired some more skills, and ultimately started Speak Wellness.
Speaking of children, you held the first trap therapy session open to children in May, and you have another tonight. How are sessions different when you're addressing kids?
You know, I get that question all the time. The sessions are pretty similar. Huh. We just changed the analogies. We changed the examples, but the content is the same. Our young people, particularly African-Americans, suicide rates have tripled compared to our counterparts in similar age groups. I believe the ages of 12 to 17. So these conversations and the information that we're talking about, suicide prevention, self-harm, depression, anxiety, the content and the information, the messaging in short is the same. It's psychoeducation around mental health, wellness, trauma, healing, the messaging stays the same. We just change the analogies and maybe a song or two so that it's more upbeat and relevant to what they're listening to on the radio.
You have to pay attention to that. Tarsha Wiggins, he'll call you out. Tarsha Wiggins, a licensed clinical social worker, certified alcohol and drug counselor, create a program where she draws on upbeat club music to help people open up during group therapy sessions, join in on trap therapy, and making mental health therapy accessible to all. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tarsha Wiggins here on the Ideas Network. Using upbeat club music to dissolve stigmas surrounding mental health in underserved communities. We're exploring trap therapy and community events that merge positive mental health messaging with trap music. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Mental Health America, analyzing 2018 federal data, half of Black and African American adults with serious mental illness do not receive treatment. Join in on stigmas, on disparities, barriers, access. 800-642-1234. Tarsha Wiggins is a licensed clinical social worker with us for about 9 more minutes. Tarsha, we've seen the reports on access to care. You know, Harvard saying that 25% of Black Americans seek mental health care compared to 40% of white Americans. What are the barriers for people of color getting access to mental health treatment?
That's a great question. Before we jump to that, I just also have to acknowledge that according to SAMHSA, they also did a research and found that only 1 in 3 African-Americans will seek treatment. So I think part of the problem is, why are individuals open or feeling comfortable to seeking the treatment? And with that, their research revealed that those other 2 individuals don't seek treatment out of concerns of guilt, stigma, and shame. They don't want to be disrespected. They don't want to be seen less as. They don't want to be mistreated. And I think that that's truly why Speaking Wellness was founded, is to abolish that stigma around seeking mental health treatment, about acknowledging that you're not okay at this moment in your life, but you're going to become okay. Things can get better. So I think the first part is what we've spent some time talking about, which is that stigma, that guilt, and that shame. The second part, when we talk about accessing the care, when we look just within the community of African Americans, we have to look at social determinants of health, employment, access to resources and or insurance. So I think it's a variety of all of those things, in addition to how are you going to be perceived by your potential mental health practitioner, prescriber, therapist, psychologist, right? Like, all of those things play a factor. There's been so much historical trauma that has happened in the medical field with African Americans as well. So unfortunately, it's a perfect storm with a combination of a little bit of everything. So you throw the guilt, stigma, and shame in there, access, social determinants of care, historical medical trauma, and you get this huge barrier and all these obstacles individuals have to encounter when they do move past or beyond the initial, I'm not going to be let guilt or stigma or any of those things hold me back. Now there's all these other things that they have to encounter.
Also thinking about as well, and you brought this up, I think, at the beginning about, you know, does my community, does my therapist look like me? Do they have similar experiences like me? Have they felt the ways I have felt? How important is that, especially for Black and brown communities?
Oh, that's extremely important. I think that there's a lot of value, just a lot of added value when you can connect and engage with someone where just some things just don't have to be said or have to be shared or explained. And I also want to be really clear about, your therapist doesn't necessarily have to have the same skin color as you, but do we connect or do we have other mutual connectedness? Like, do we have the same beliefs? Do I see that I'm in a space where I'm safe, or this person is here, we are aligned in other ways? So I think it's the combination of all of those things that make it immensely important. And when we think about it, even from the outside of that clinical perspective, when you seek therapy or treatment in that area, there's such a place of vulnerability where I have to trust you. I have to feel comfortable with you. And everything we described thus far helps me feel comfortable so that I can connect, tap in, do the work so that I can move towards my wellness.
Talking about mental wellness and access to therapy and stigmas, Tarsha Wiggins with us, a Milwaukee-based clinical social worker, and talking about trap therapy in particular. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Tarsha, if someone is suffering from a severe mental illness, I would imagine that trap therapy isn't the first line of action, but how do you see trap therapy fitting into the spectrum of mental health care, mental health treatment in America?
So the way I envision it is that this is a bridge. This is oftentimes individuals' first time ever doing anything or coming out or just listening to anything about our mental, emotional wellness. So oftentimes this is me planting the seed, starting that process, introducing them to, and this is what therapy is like. These are things that you work on in therapy. It's not the cliche, go sit on a couch, lay back and tell me how does that make you feel. It's an interactive process. So I like to be that first line of defense, that planting the seed, informing individuals about what therapy is like, what you can expect, how to engage in a group therapy session, and or how can I help you or support you with becoming connected with additional resources. I encourage everyone, in the height of the pandemic, I think we all needed to check in with someone about something. We go every year for a wellness check for our physical health. We should also be checking in once a year with someone about our mental and or emotional health.
Can you give us some wisdom, if you will, some words of hope for people who are struggling with mental health challenges and haven't accessed care?
Oh, absolutely. I encourage everyone that today is not forever. Today, your struggle today, what you're dealing with, this is not forever. There is always something that can change. And just leaving that hope that this can change, or better yet, this will change. Whatever the thing is, whatever the ailment is, whatever the diagnosis is, perhaps whatever your stressor is, because a lot of times we get stuck on what the diagnosis is. I look at more than just what the diagnosis is. Let's look at the symptoms. Your sleep can get better. Your feelings of loneliness can get better. Your symptoms of anxiety, that worry, those racing thoughts, those things can get better. It's about, what do you have to do? What can I do to help support you? And we can figure that out together. But in short, this will get better.
So nothing is insurmountable. With some work and some you know, steps forward and effort, I'm wondering too, how do you take those initial steps? Because it can be scary, and perhaps, you know, you might not even have insurance. It might not be, you think it's not financially achievable, even if there is mental health care around you in a community.
That's a great question. So there is help at every level. Commercial insurance, no insurance. HMO, Medicaid, Medicare, there are services available for individuals that have no insurance, or maybe their insurance doesn't cover things in a full spectrum of services. The city of Milwaukee Guys, we live in an amazing city here with just a wealth of resources. There are access clinics throughout the city of Milwaukee where you can go onto the behavioral health website and identify. I do believe there's one at Whole Health Clinical Group, and there's one at WCS as well, Wisconsin Community Services, two hubs in the city of Milwaukee where there are walk-in clinics where you can be assessed and get start your process to get set up with behavioral health services. And that is eligible for individuals that are underserved and or don't have insurance as well. So those are places that you can start. Other areas for individuals that may have insurance, flip the back of your insurance card over or go online and you can do your provider search and you can put in criteria that makes you know maybe you want to work with a female or maybe you want a therapist that is Spanish speaking or you know other requirements or things that would help you feel more comfortable. And you can start your process there as well. But what I always encourage individuals to also keep in mind is that it's a process.
It's a process. Tarsha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tarsha Wiggins, licensed clinical social worker, certified alcohol and drug counselor, created a form of therapy she coined as trap therapy, holds community sessions in the Milwaukee area. Ahead this hour, nurses at UW Health are the latest to push for collective bargaining. A union leader from the Minnesota Nurses Association has takeaways on organizing and labor negotiations in our neighboring state. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next, and Wisconsin Life here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin audience question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it for miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the star of Rib Mountain's story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? And how big is the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Seward. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers, and those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone, and it was deposited by ancient seas, and then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs, Hardwood Hill, Mozanie Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker, those kinds of mountains. So several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away. Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Genoviak had a question about that too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around it. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now to unionizing and healthcare. Shout out to Linda in Appleton for suggesting this conversation during our recent Caller Only Hour. Wisconsin's Attorney General issued an 11-page opinion earlier this month giving clarity on bargaining rights for UW health nurses. The upshot is the hospital system can recognize employee unions under Wisconsin law and bargain with them. Now, in the Twin Ports, nurses held an informational picket yesterday as contracts for thousands of RNs at Essentia Health and St. Luke's expire at the end of the month. Join in 800-642-1234. Chris Rubish is first vice president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, a registered nurse for Essentia in Duluth. Their union contract also covers some nurses at St. Mary's Hospital in Superior. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so can you give us a little sense of the informational picket? What was that like yesterday? What occurred?
Sure. So we had thousands of nurses joining us on the streets in front of our employers, Essentia, Twin Ports, and St. Luke's Hospitals. As you mentioned, nurses at my bargaining unit, Essentia Twin Ports, come from both sides of the bridge, so both Superior and Duluth. And, you know, we were bringing our message to the public about our concerns for staffing and providing safe healthcare to our patients in the hospital.
Contracts expire next week, and correct me here, but this is for about 2,500 nurses for hospitals operated by St. Luke's and Essentia Health. What are you seeking in the new contract?
Sure. So really what we're seeing is a need to keep nurses at the bedside. We need nurses now more than ever. And so we're looking for contract provisions that would recruit and retain nurses and address our concerns around staffing of our units.
What can you say about ongoing negotiations? How is it going?
You know, it's been a difficult process so far. We've been negotiating since mid-April, and, you know, we just have not yet had the type of difficult but necessary conversations, especially around staffing, that we're really hoping to with management. And that's ultimately why we were picketing yesterday. We were hoping that our public action and that public pressure would bring management, to the table to discuss those difficult issues with us.
What is it like to negotiate with hospital leaders in these pandemic times?
Yeah, you know, we always come to the table ready to have those difficult conversations. The pandemic has certainly shone a brighter light on issues like staffing. But I think it's really important to point out that those concerns that we have were not created by this pandemic. They've been, something we've been experiencing for decades. And this has certainly put additional strain on our healthcare systems. But nurses have been feeling these struggles of needing to keep and retain nurses in tough conditions for a long, long time, longer than I've even been a nurse.
But the tensions around the pandemic, they're there. I mean, do you think it's harder to win some concessions because the hospital leaders can say, look, we're in a pandemic, we're in an emergency? How much has that been a legitimate reason?
You know, it's been something we've been hearing. I think I would have a deeper conversation and maybe push back a little bit on saying that that's the sole deeper reason. We have seen, especially for my healthcare system and others in Minnesota, that profits have been going up. CEO compensation has been going up. So I think there's a broader conversation to have, and it's a little too easy for management to point to the pandemic and say, see, this is the cause of our problems.
Can you go a little bit more deeply for me into short staffing and the retention crisis? Because, you know, earlier in the pandemic, we were hearing about throngs of people in healthcare leaving, especially nurses, because of burnout.
Yeah, absolutely. Burnout is one term for it. Recently, we've been trying to refer to it as moral distress, moral injury, because this is really affecting nurses and other healthcare workers' mental health as well. I can cite in the state of Minnesota, we have more registered nurses with nursing licenses than at any point in the last 5 years. We also have fewer nurses practicing at the bedside than at any point in the last 5 years. So I think what we're experiencing is less of a nursing shortage than it is a shortage of nurses who are willing to work in these conditions. And it's time that management at all the facilities we're bargaining with really come to understand that and realize that if they want to manage, then they need to work with us and provide solutions to that.
Can you go more deeply into the steps to establishing a union? Because, I mean, I'm sure you're watching what's happening here with UW Health, but I understand you have insights because the Minnesota Nurses Association assisted with a successful union drive in Bismarck, North Dakota. What happened there?
Yeah, definitely. So the Minnesota Nurses Association, most of our members are in Minnesota, but we do represent facilities in Wisconsin, in Hudson, River Falls, and Superior, as well as Iowa and North Dakota. Most recently, we assisted nurses at St. Alexius Hospital in Bismarck, unionized. That was the first successful unionization in North Dakota in almost 50 years. And it's a long process. There's a number of legal measures that must be, achieved to obtain a union. As you mentioned at the top of the program, once a majority of members at a facility trying to unionize have signed a petition seeking a union, the employer can voluntarily recognize that union. And that would be, the easiest and quickest way to achieve a union. And of course, it would be what we would be looking for to create a mutually beneficial cooperative relationship with an employer. If the employer doesn't want to voluntarily recognize that union, then we would proceed to an election that would be supervised by the National Labor Relations Board. And they would come in, and every member of the bargaining unit or prospective bargaining unit would get to cast a vote of whether or not they wanted to join a union.
What was that aftermath like in Bismarck? What happened there to be able to get that union established?
Sure. So generally, there are issues that bring the nurses to the point where they're looking to say, hey, a union is what we need to do to collectively raise our voices get our message across to management. That happened in Bismarck. They were concerned about their patient care. In the state of Bismarck, their Nursing Practice Act, which is the legislation that governs what a nurse can and can't do legally under their license in each state, their Nurse Practice Act isn't as strong as other states like Minnesota and Wisconsin. So they were seeking protections around their patient care, and through a union and union negotiating, they would be able to get those into their contract. So they approached us, and over the course of a little more than a year, we worked with them to develop internal structures in the hospital, teams of nurses to educate and talk to each other, in both at work and outside of the job, until we got to the point that the nurses said, yeah, we have a groundswell here. We have a majority ready to vote. We turned in that petition, went public, and called for an election. And of course, won that vote. And since then, they've successfully negotiated their first contract, are really a very strong and well-organized bargaining unit today.
Chris Rubish with us, first vice president for the Minnesota Nurses Association, a registered nurse in Duluth. Join in your story: compensation, contract negotiations, collective bargaining, burnout, understaffing. Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Chris Rubish here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with a leader from the Minnesota Nurses Association. As nurses in the Twin Ports, they held an informational picket yesterday, not a work stoppage, not walking off the job, but calling attention to their contracts, staffing shortages, pandemic, work environment, patient safety, as we've been talking about. Join in on collective bargaining in healthcare, what you're seeing. 800-642-1234. RN in Duluth, Chris Rubish, first vice president for the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents nurses in four states, including Wisconsin, with us for about nine more minutes. So, Chris, in 2011, our governor signed into law Act 10, which ended most collective bargaining for state employees. And the union contract the nurses at UW Health had in place at the time Act 10 was passed, that contract expired in 2014. What would you say to nurses who have not had union representation for nearly a decade?
Yeah, well, I would say that my opportunity to participate in my union provides not only security for me to be able to speak up on issues like patient safety, but it also provides a really important avenue for me to be involved civically in things like legislation and working to influence policy around healthcare as well. And that's something that I'm really proud that we do as a healthcare union.
Where have you seen policy legislation inroads in Minnesota?
Yeah, well, we had two really major legislative victories this year in Minnesota. One was a presumptive eligibility for workers' compensation coverage around COVID-19 exposure. So we were taking care of COVID patients in hospitals and healthcare settings. And so we had legislation passed that gave presumptive eligibility to coverage for workers' compensation if we got COVID-19. And that was really important to make sure that our nurses stayed safe and that they were able to continue to safely care for their patients. Our other victory was around staffing and a staffing legislation. We were able to pass that in our House of Representatives. We had a commitment from our governor to sign that legislation. Unfortunately, we didn't get it passed in the Senate, but that progress we saw was more progress we've seen on a statewide staffing solution than we've had in three decades.
What does a staffing solution look like to you?
Sure. Well, there are a couple different models across the country. In a state like California, they have state required ratios. Those are the same healthcare to patient ratios at every facility across the state. In Minnesota, our legislation, we feel, was a more Midwest solution to a staffing problem. The bill would have set up staffing committees at each individual healthcare facility. It would have brought together both management and healthcare workers on that committee and set patient care ratios based on the needs at that facility, the staffing at that facility, the patient acuity at that facility. So it was really a local solution, but addressing the problem because it does exist everywhere.
Along the lines of staffing, I wonder, how does your union approach the issue of mandatory overtime for nurses?
Sure. So we are addressing that contract by contract. My bargaining unit, which, as we said at the top of the show, represents nurses in Superior as well as across the bridge in Duluth, our contract doesn't allow us to be mandated. And we think that that's very important because mandatory overtime The longer nurses and other healthcare workers are on the job, the more tired we get, the more likely we are to, you know, expose people to, risks and errors. And that's absolutely something that is never acceptable. And it needs to be the choice of the healthcare worker to say, I'm too tired, I'm not safe to continue on this job. And mandating someone to stay in any healthcare role just is not the solution.
Talking about healthcare worker unionization, specifically in nursing, Chris Rubish, part of the leadership team for the Minnesota Nurses Association, as we look at what this is in four states, 800-642-1234 to join in. So this month, our Attorney General Josh Call said UW hospitals could enter into voluntary collective bargaining with a union, despite state law, as we talked about, limiting unions for most public workers. And nurses at UW Health have been working on trying to unionize for a couple of years now. What do you see as the legal barriers that healthcare workers face when starting up unions?
You know, I think it varies state to state. In our experience working with nurses in North Dakota, that was the first successful unionizing effort in the state of North Dakota for almost 50 years. And there was definitely a culture there where people didn't have a lot of experience or contact with unions. So we needed to start with a lot of education, supporting those members as they talked to each other about what their rights were. In a state where there's the potential for a employer to voluntarily recognize a union, like your attorney general just issued the opinion on, that's an important foundation for creating a dialogue between workers and management. And that would be our ideal outcome. Any employer can voluntarily recognize a union. And that would be, what I would say would be the gold standard for management to come to workers and say, we want to work with you on this. Let's reach an agreeable contract. An election is the next step, and workers will obviously pursue that, if management won't voluntarily recognize the union. But we would hope that they would want to work with workers in any institution, including at UW Health.
There are tremendous headwinds out there beyond state laws. I mean, you watch large companies like Amazon and Starbucks oppose union formation at their warehouses and their coffee shops. How much does that high-profile opposition to unions affect your efforts locally to unionize?
Mm-hmm. Although it might seem a little counterintuitive, I actually think it adds some fuel to our workers. I think workers just want to have a conversation and be involved in affecting their workplace. In my case, they want to be involved in decisions around patient care, things like staffing, as we've been talking about. And when you see aggressive anti-union tactics from employers, I think it really tips management's hand, right? It shows management, it shows our workers that management doesn't want to work with them. You know, they don't want a collegial relationship. And I think that makes workers just double down and be more invested in saying, then it's time to show up and get involved.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Chris Rubish is first vice president for the Minnesota Nurses Association, that union representing 22,000 nurses in four states, including Wisconsin. Chris, a registered nurse in Duluth, Minnesota. Just ahead, we talk with an architect about elevating Indigenous culture and voices in the field of architecture and design. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.